So yesterday, the Toronto Blue Jays managed to get back to 500 on the season, a notable mark. Although, really,
hold on, it's 12 games. Really, it's 12 games. 12 That's games. Come on.
Well, let me finish the sentence, and then you know.
Then why would I let you finish now? I haven't let you finish for 20 years.
No, and you didn't do it there either. That's twice you've interrupted me. We've been on for 24 seconds. And now I forget where I was going to go with all this. Blue Jays beat the New York Yankees, walk off by the little shortstop who had quite a day and has now hit in 11 consecutive games. And after a slow start, starting to look like the guy we thought he was. But we're going to address early season baseball and a whole variety of other things. What does it mean? What do you take from 2 weeks of baseball? Do you find out anything about your team? Like, if you were a GM, Shannon, would you even contemplate making a trade 2 weeks into the season? Maybe
well, this is
a catastrophic injury to one of your players, but it takes time.
The question for me in this sport, in Major League Baseball, is it the 40 game mark or the 60 game mark? You know, that isn't that the real question to reevaluate? That's what everybody always says. Well, it's either 40. It depends who you talk to. It's either the 40 game mark. It's the 40 game mark if your owner says, "Holy smokes, we're 20-20. You said we'd be 30-10." And for the teams that are in the middle, it's the 60 game mark, you know, when the pennant races, when do the races start? Right after the, you know, in the 162 game season, do they start at the All-Star game? When is the turnaround? Remember when the Jays in 2015 went on their great run, it was August the 1st, Bob.
I know.
August the 1st. And that's when they made
moves at the July 31st trade deadline.
That's right. And it changed then went the on whole a run. Personality. Yeah.
I think they were below 500 at the time.
I think they were. I think you're right. I think you're right. So this is the sport where patience and understanding the ebbs and flows of a Major League Baseball season. You do take your time. So I mean, 60 games to me makes the most sense. So we got 48 games to go before we can panic for any team in Major League Baseball.
Well, we'll see if our guest is prepared to make any analysis of the first 2 weeks of the season. He's the noted baseball writer columnist for the New York Post. Ken Davidoff will join us when the program continues after these messages. Well, we are now a couple of weeks into the baseball season and not enough time, John, to really make any kind of assessment, I don't think, of what's gone on and what might go on.
And you know what, Bob, it's still, you know, for us in Toronto and in Canada, it's still strange because we don't have our home team, you know, and they can sit there in Dunedin all they want and win as they did yesterday. But there's still something missing because they're not at the stadium down the street.
Yeah. We are joined by Ken Davidoff, the noted baseball writer, columnist for the New York Post, who is with us this morning. Good of you to join us, Ken. Thank you. Are you used to baseball in a pandemic era now? Has it become kind of second nature?
It has, Robert. I think what's interesting to me is that it feels so much better this year. I mean, I went to a ton of games last year and it was a horror show, you know, just being on those empty ballparks. I was confined to my seat in the press box, really pretty restricted movement. And at least now to have some fans there, I find very, very meaningful.
I said to John at the top, I think you heard, you can't really make any assessments 12 games into a regular season or whatever we're at here, which is, it's about right. But have you learned anything about any of these teams? I mean, there are a few surprises, but I mean, the Boston Red Sox were picked by almost everybody to finish last or contend with Baltimore for last place. And they're first and they got the second best record in baseball. Doesn't mean much, does it?
It really doesn't. You know, it's fine. April is a tough month for people in my line of work, you know, cover baseball, because baseball is a marathon unlike any other sport. And it's just really hard to draw any meaningful conclusions over such a tiny sample size.
So we can't rejoice over the Jays' victory over the Yankees yesterday?
You can certainly rejoice in the daily results. You know, you just don't want to, put down your down payment for the playoff tickets quite yet.
Well, I would say the only thing that's rather predictable here is the Dodgers are off to a 10-2 start. They're the best team in baseball, and they're showing it. It's baseball, though. Anybody's beatable. But this Dodger team is almost getting to the point, I wonder if you agree, of being historically good.
I certainly think it's fair to pose that question. They're an excellent, excellent roster. Really just everything you could want, right? I mean, maybe the bullpen is a little bit of a vulnerability, but not a huge vulnerability. And I didn't even pick them to make the World Series. I think that was just the randomness of baseball. But yeah, if we're talking about just their talent level and their ceiling, it's fair to talk about history.
They are still spending at a rate that exceeds everybody else and by a fairly significant margin. Reflect on that a little bit, because it was not so many years ago where the New York Yankees were that team and the Boston Red Sox were not far behind. It's not that the Dodgers didn't spend in years gone by, but they've just kind of come to the point where I guess their payroll is their payroll and they're prepared to spend that amount of money every year.
Well, I'm pretty sure last year the Yankees had the number one payroll.
Did they really?
Yeah. So we're not talking about a team, you know, 5-year trend or anything like that. I mean, yeah, for sure. The Dodgers, since this ownership group took over, the Guggenheim group, they've been top three. But last year with the Yankees, were number one. And if they hadn't signed Trevor Bauer, why I think they viewed as a special case, I think they and the Yankees would be neck and neck.
How would you handicap the Yankees? Where is their weakness? And does Garrett Cole deliver everything he's supposed to do for that starting rotation?
Well, Garrett Cole has been outstanding. He was very good last year, and he's been even better this year in his first three starts. The Yankees are an interesting team. You know, they have arguably the most talent in the American League, but it's just a matter of, do all the parts fit? You know, are they too right-handed in their lineup? Are they athletic enough? Are there too many defensive questions? Do they have the starters behind Cole? So as we talk here, they are 5-7, and which is certainly disappointing. I do think, again, talking about how April, you don't want to go too crazy, I think they'll wind up winning the American League East.
Are they short in any area? Is there anything that specifically you would say this is a need that they have yet to address?
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. I mean, I think their clear concern has to be their starting rotation. And we've seen so far, I mean, Cole has been excellent. Jordan Montgomery has been a solid number two. He's not really the number two starter. He's been fine for what he is. The questions have surrounded the two new guys, Corey Kluber and Jameson Taillon, and then Domingo Germán, who is a returning guy, didn't play at all last year. He got suspended for domestic violence. And I think the key questions around those three, because all three, I think most would agree, have very big upside, high ceilings, but very little reliability. And so far, those three have not delivered.
Yeah, I was going to say, didn't Kluber come with a pretty good pedigree? Wasn't he supposed to be better than this?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they paid him $11 million because of that pedigree, because he had an absolutely spectacular audition, you know, a throwing session in January. But we're talking about a guy who threw one inning last year for the Texas Rangers before suffering an injury to his shoulder. I think it was his latissimus dorsi. And who in 2019 was not very good with the Indians. Had a couple injuries, but in between injuries did not pitch well. So the Yankees are paying for $11 million because they think this guy can be what he approach what he was during his peak with Cleveland, which is when he won two Cy Young awards.
Right.
Well, and if he's that guy, if he doesn't kind of fall off the table, a mediocre year a couple of seasons ago and then the injury last year, I mean, this is a $20, $25 million a year pitcher, right?
Yeah. Did you guys watch the game yesterday?
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, he allowed 3 runs in 4 innings, which is not great, obviously.
No.
But he got 15 swings and misses. So there's something there. This is not a guy who's done. This is a guy who's trying to figure some things out, needs to stay healthy, which he has not done the prior 2 years. But this is a guy, to me, I came away from yesterday's start saying, all right, I want to see more of this, because even though he didn't deliver as he's paid to in that game, he showed you some stuff.
Although the swings and misses, I think we can inform you, may be more a result of the Blue Jays' uber-aggressiveness. Then Bloomer's great stuff.
You might be right.
Give me your take on this this Blue Jay team. It is young. It aspires to be good. Many people think they are close. Do you agree with that assessment?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the Blue Jays' history over the last decade has been fascinating, right? I mean, you had Alex Anthopoulos, the native Canadian, putting together this juggernaut in 2015, and then Alex steps down when there's a change at the president level, with Marsha Power replacing Paul. Oh my Beeston. God! Thank you,
Beeston.
Mental lapse there. Of course, the great Paul Beeston, and you know, so Alex steps down, and they take a few years there, you know, kind of tear things down, and then they felt like Alex did not build something that was sustainable, right? That they needed to take a step back, which they did, and ramp back up, which they have. And I mean, it's a fun team to watch. You know, I covered all three of these Yankees Blue Jays games remotely from up in New York. And I mean, you know, just Biggio and Bichette, and obviously Vladdy Jr., and even Grichuk filling in for Springer. They're just a fun team to watch.
You shouldn't say, obviously, Vladdy Guerrero, because there's a lot of people in this town that have been waiting for this. It didn't show up last year. The 42 pounds weight loss changed a lot of that. I think that we're all, maybe Bob isn't, but we're all surprised how well he's played at first base, even defensively. I mean, and so from that perspective, this is found money in many ways, based on where everybody else was supposed to go, because Vladdy had kind of plateaued. Don't you think, Bob?
Well, he certainly had underperformed based upon expectations. I mean, I don't recall a player coming into the Blue Jay organization with greater expectations than Vladdy Jr.
No.
And I know internationally there was something of a consensus to that. And we know, Kenny, that there are all kinds of players who light it up in the minor leagues, and when they get to the bigs, they fall flat on their face,
or they started another team and move, like Stanton, you know.
Well, or they take, you know, they take several steps back before they manage to get back to the plateau or close to the plateau that you thought they would achieve. But this guy looked like a, you know, at 16 years old, he looked like he was on his way to the Hall of Fame at some point, don't you think?
Well,
yeah, well, look, I think with baseball especially, you have to look at guys' ages, right? I mean, the Yankees have this with Gleyber Torres. He's 24, and all this hand-wringing over his defense at shortstop, and you know, it's valid. You know, he's not your classic shortstop in his build. He's not that athletic a guy. But I always believe, let the guy, you know, let him get his reps in and learn. And Vladdy Jr. is 22. I mean, he's a baby. And to his credit, you know, to lose all that weight and to get better. Because when I talk about, obviously, I'm talking about his obvious ceiling, right? His obvious
sure.
talents. And it's you know, tip of the cap to him for doing a better job of maximizing those talents.
It's interesting. This is the major sports in North America, there is such now a lack of patience in letting players mature. And I would suspect you might agree that baseball, more than any other, requires patience.
I agree 1,000%. And it's interesting when we see there has been an evolution, right? I mean, when all of us were tots, guys would spend a lot longer time in the minor leagues. And now it's standard for how many at-bats you need in the minor leagues, how many innings you need in the minor leagues, has really dropped. You know, they'd rather get the guy up and get going to get his prime years. So often we will see more growing pains in the major leagues.
I would assume that you covered the Yankee. You were a Yankee fan as a kid. I mean, the Yankees were the greatest example of that, with all those guys, you know, with Bernie and Derek, and, you know, starting in A-ball together, right? And they worked their way up through every league before they got to the big team.
Yeah, I mean, to nitpick, Bernie is actually about 5 years older than the rest of those guys.
Okay, fair enough.
Jeter, Rivera, Posada, Pettit, they all grew up in the minors together. And,
right.
You know, one of the things that occurs to me, guys, I wonder if it's coincidence or whether there's something to the fact that Guerrero has now, or appears to be, emerging as the kind of player most of us thought he would be now that he is at first base. And we talk about the defensive relevance of that, but I wonder how much that impacts his offensive abilities, in that when he came up, he was perceived as a defensive liability at third base, made a lot of bad throws, didn't have great range, clearly. Now he goes to first base. Is it the hardest position in the world to learn defensively? Well, no, it's probably the easiest. But he, as John said, he's doing a really good job, picks a lot of balls out of the dirt, has made very few mistakes over there. And I wonder whether you think, Kenny, that can influence his offensive confidence and abilities simultaneously.
Yes. I don't know Vladdy Jr. well. I've done a couple group interviews with him, so I can't really speak to whether that's specifically the case. But yeah, that's certainly a theory that makes a great deal of sense.
You know, the thing that, Bob, you talk about, what we're seeing now with him is his athletic ability. The play he made that went to review yesterday, he looked like Johnny Bauer or Eddie Jockman. He didn't look like a first baseman. I pulled my groin watching him do that. we're seeing that athletic ability finally back in Guerrero, that quite frankly I don't think we ever saw at third base. We never saw it at third base.
No, and the truth of the matter is that 6 months ago, all the conversation was about this guy winding up as a full-time DH.
Right.
And that there wasn't going to be a place for him, that he can't play third base and he probably can't play first base, so he's going to wind up as a DH. And now I think Rowdy Tellez is going to have a hard time getting into more than 15 or 20 games at first base over the course of the year. Is there a shockingly disappointing team that you've seen? I know that Yankee fans will be disappointed that the Yankees are 5-7. Big whoop. But is there somebody else you've seen that you are surprised at how poor they might be?
Well, I think the one team that stands out is the Atlanta Braves. They're 4-8. I picked them to win the World Series, so I'm not sweating it yet. I mean, 4-8 is, again, we're talking about such small sample sizes, but they're a team that has performed their outperformed their statistical projections for many years now, and they were projected by many of these services to be 500 or worse, and maybe this is the year that catches up with them, but I'm still gonna bet on them.
Talk a little bit about the Mets. 5-3, I think they are at this point, with limited games played. This is a team that many think is emerging. Do you concur with that assessment, first of all?
Oh, sure. I mean, they're the new owner there. The old owner was absolutely hated by the fan base, and that's an understatement. And they have built up a nice amount of roster depth. obviously the Lindor trade, even though he's not doing great so far. But yeah, they're clearly on the upswing.
I couldn't help but smile. I don't know if you noticed Marcus Stroman getting into a Twitter fight with a few fans the other day, talking about he was sticking up for somebody within the organization, and people don't know what they're talking about. And that's the Marcus Stroman we know here in Toronto. Does he have the same reputation in New York?
You know, it's been weird, John. You know, they got him in 2019. So he was a Met for 2 months, bad the first month, very good the second month. Then he opted out last year. So he was kind of an app, you know, that was it. And, you know, then he was a free agent. Then he accepted the qualifying offer to come back. So he's here on a 1 year deal. So I have to say, like, he hasn't made that large of an impact, you know, just in terms of who he is. You know, I don't think Mets fans really have been able to connect with him. But that's not from a lack of trying on his part.
You know, right.
he is always active on social media. You know, two very good starts so far. I think he's going to have a really good year.
Yeah, I spent 5 years commuting from Toronto to New York. The Yankees come out of the concrete. I mean, everywhere you go, the Yankees come out of the concrete, and the Mets, and this was albeit the previous ownership, and the Mets just try hard to get some attention. Will there ever be a time when it's not a Yankee town? Will there ever be a time when is it all based on wins and losses?
Yeah, well, the Mets have a passionate, huge following. And you see that, you know, every time the Mets are good, you see that passion and that volume. You know, if you go back to 2015 when they made the World Series, I mean, it's just different when the Mets are good because their fans appreciate it, right? Because they've suffered so much. Whereas the Yankees fans are, I mean, you're not going to find a more spoiled bunch of fans than the Yankees fans. So it's just different. Even I know it, you know, because we have our internal analytics. Every time I write a column, you know, I can see how many people are clicking it online. And my Mets pieces generally do better than my Yankees pieces because
really,
because Mets fans are just more engaged.
I'm curious, when you do the analytics, do Mets fans push back at you more, or do you Yankee fans push back at you more particularly when you're critical of the teams?
No, I'd say Yankees fans are, if anything, Yankees fans give me grief for not being more critical of the team. Whereas Mets fans are more likely to defend their team. Although, you know, again, not so much in the Wolpon era.
I'm intrigued as a New Yorker. I'm intrigued by the how somebody, this is going to sound stupid, becomes a Mets fan versus a Yankees fan. And I'm sure this is the case to a great extent with all cities, New York, Chicago, LA, where there are two teams in the same sport. Is it solely history? Is it all about who your dad cheered for? Is there a definitive geographic breakdown of metropolitan New York? This area is Yankees territory and this area is Mets territory. How does that work in your opinion?
Bob, I think it's a blend. I think everything you mentioned is a factor there. You know, certainly your parents are a factor. Geography is a factor. You know, Long Islanders, you know, they're closer to Queens where the Mets play. So yeah, definitely Long Island is more Mets territory. And then New Jersey, Westchester Connecticut tend to be more Yankees territory because they're closer to Yankee Stadium. Look, I was born in 1971, and I think I first liked the Mets more, but, you know, then the Yankees won the World Series in 1977-78, so, you know, I jumped on the bandwagon. But my son, you know, so for my job now, I have to recuse myself from that. You know, I'm not a fan at all anymore.
Of course.
But, like, my son's a contrarian. So in 2009, when the Yankees won it all and the Mets stunk, my son decided to pick the Mets, and he's now, so, you know, so that was his personal, nature, you know? So again, it's sort of a blend of all these different things.
Is it common for people to jump back and forth, Mets fan 1 year, Yankees fan the next year, or do Mets fans hate Yankee fans and vice versa?
I think it's the latter, Bob. And I really think that's changed because I know, so the Yankees won in 77, 78. When the Mets won in 86, I was thrilled for the Mets. You know, I was rooting for the Mets. And everyone in my little world felt the same way. Like there wasn't that hatred then. And maybe, I don't know if that's because of interleague play, because of social media, because just in general, everything on our planet now is more divisive. But I do think that things have changed.
Actually, that you brought up something because Bob and I, we you know, we're a little older than you, and we lament at times interleague play. We lament, we loved the mystery of American League versus National League. Has interleague play helped the rivalry or hurt it?
I think it's helped it. You know, look, I think, you know, this evolution we're talking about, I think that's good for business, right? Like, I think the more passion you can bring to anything, the better. I think that interleague baseball has succeeded because of those early Yankees Mets years. When you talk about the late 90s, early 2000s, those rivalries, those games were so intense. Oh my God. You know, you had Jeter, you had Piazza, you had Roger Clemens. I mean, Joe Torre managing the Yankees, Bobby Valentine managing the Mets. There was just so much color and drama in those games. And I think that really carried the whole experiment and has made it a success to this day.
But, you know, one thing that we are seeing now in the National Hockey League, I don't know if you're a hockey fan at all, but with this. Yeah, a little bit. Very good. French.
That means he's a Ranger fan. There's no chance he's a Devil or an Islander fan. That means he's a Ranger fan.
I root for that. I went to the University of Michigan. Not too far from your fine country. And so I root for the alums in the NHL, NFL, and NBA.
Oh, yeah. Very smooth, Ken. That's very smooth of you. That's good.
good, a Michigan fan.
So that means you, Bob, that means you like Zach Hyman. That means he likes Zach Hyman.
Yeah.
Who's going to make a lot of money this summer as a free agent. So
there's, by the way, Kenny, there's over my shoulder is an Ohio State logo.
Oh no. Interview over.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you can't beat them, win. And Michigan can't beat Ohio State.
No, so, it cannot. It cannot.
Where was I going to go with this? We were talking about
interleague play.
Yeah, interleague play.
You said hockey.
Yeah, and hockey. Thank you. So what we are seeing now, as you're aware, is these divisional rivalries, and they only play in their division. They don't play anyplace else. And what looms are the Stanley Cup playoffs, whereby that when you get to the semifinals and the final, you're going to see two teams that have not played each other all year. Now, the significance of that may be negligible, but it harkens back to the days before interleague play in baseball, when if you were an American League fan, a Yankee fan, for example, when you got to the World Series, you were going to see a team that you have watched perhaps on television, your scouts have scouted, but as a fan base, you probably don't know very much about them. And you could have two teams with the exact same records going into the World Series, but you're not sure the relevance of those records because the competition is completely different. Isn't there merit in that?
I think there is a lot of merit in that, Bob, and I share your romantic view of what it was like pre-interleague play. But I think there do have to be some business realities. You know, I think, like, I always flash back to the last time the Angels came to the Mets, the Citi Field. I think it was 2017. And just that oohing and aahing about Mike Trout being in Citi Field. And, you know, sold more tickets, got better TV ratings. And I do like, you know, the way I don't love interleague baseball, the way it's structured. I hate how with these, I don't know, who's the Blue Jays regional rival? Like the, you know, who they play every year a lot in the National League. I don't even know. But like,
Phillies. Isn't the Phillies?
The Phillies? Okay. So it's Yankees, Mets play each other at least four times a year. I think this year it's six because it's East. But I hate that. I just think it's stupid, you know, and there's no scheduling integrity to that. Right. But I do like how, you know, for the most part, all right, so the Blue Jays play the Dodgers every 3 years. And so when the Dodgers come to Toronto once every 6 years, that's a treat, right? So it's there's still some mystery there. You know, I get what you're saying. It was definitely unique back then and special. But, you know, now when the LA Dodgers and the all the superstars they have come to Toronto once every 6 years, I think there's going to be a bump in ticket sales, TV ratings, and all that. So I do think that's nice.
Well, of course, I couldn't care less about revenue. They can do what they want. Yeah. It doesn't put any money in my pocket. So,
actually, can you bring you've tweaked me to another question. So, is this the last year we're going to see the National League by itself with no DH?
Oh yeah, I think so. Yes.
And why do you think they didn't do it for this year?
Oh, because the owners and players hate each other's guts, and they're letting their petty dislike of each other get in the way of common sense. So Major League Baseball, the owners said to the players, we'll give you the DH, you know, the National League in return for the expanded playoffs. And the players said, well, no, the expanded playoffs is worth far more to you guys than the universal DH is worth to us. So we're not going to do that. And they said, okay. And they returned to their respective corners. And that was that.
We got to take a break. We're a little late. We'll do that. We'll come back. Ken Davidoff of the New York Post is with us back after these messages. With Ken Davidoff of the New York Post, and Bob McCowan. That's John Shannon over there.
Yes, sir.
You touched on the playoff situation before we took the break. What would you like to see in terms of baseball playoffs? Are you a purist? I mean, and I'm not saying you go back to the days where you had a winner in the American League and a winner in the National League. There were no playoffs. And you went straight from 162 to the World Series, or 154, maybe at that point. But
Ken's not that old.
No, but I mean, he's certainly enough of a historian to know what happened back then. I'm sure you just barely remember it, John.
That's right. Just a child. I used to love reading Ken's stuff when I was a kid.
So are you a purist, or do you like the concept of expanded playoffs in baseball?
Bob, I'm a realist, but yeah, I do like, I think 10 is a pretty good number, actually, 10 out of 30. And yeah, I think it's clear they're going to expand it next year. You know, like last year was such a weird season, obviously.
Of course.
I liked the 16. I thought it was fun. I thought that way that any good team that got off to a slow start still got in. And you know, that day when there were 8 playoff games at once, that was a lot of fun, right? Yeah. You know, kind of had a March Madness feel to it. But I like the idea that even this year, like a very good team is going to miss the playoffs, right? Like a team might win 90, but will certainly win 86, 87, 88 games. And I like that the bar is set high enough to leave some good teams left out.
Could you see baseball? The two things that I talk about all the time are, I like more teams in the playoffs, and unlike you, I think 10 is a minimum. I would like to see more. I do acknowledge.
Yeah, but then you got to reduce the season. You got to reduce the season.
And I like that too. I like the idea of going back to 154. That gives you an extra 9 days. In order to conduct another round of playoffs. And even if that postseason is best 2 out of 3, I don't like one game deals, but a 2 out of 3, I'm okay with that too. And from a revenue standpoint, you know, it's not hard to do the math. Giving up those 8 regular season games in order to create more teams in contention in September, that put more people in their stadia in the month of September because they're in a pennant race as opposed to out of it. And then the dramatic, as you know, increase in ticket prices for postseason games as opposed to regular season games. It just seems logical to me. I wonder sometimes if you feel, as I do, that baseball drags its feet relentlessly when it comes to change.
Well, it's interesting. I would argue that Bud Selig implemented a great deal of change during his time as commissioner. When you think
relatively speaking, I'll acknowledge, yeah.
Right, relatively speaking. Yeah, baseball does move slowly. I'm not sure. Does any sport move that quickly when it comes to change?
I tell you what, the NFL, if they don't like a rule change, they make a change. Okay. Their rules committee in the offseason goes and does something and protects every player under the sun that makes more than $10 million. They do.
Yeah.
That's what the NFL does.
It's arguably the most successful league in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to argue that. And John and I have talked about this. They have a committee that meets at the end of every year. They make rule changes if they don't work out. Yeah. Nobody loses any sleep over it. They don't get stubborn. Nope. They say, okay, we'll get rid of that. We'll make
a change. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not to change topics completely, because it becomes something that we talk about, the baseball not being ahead of the curve, but then we see what they did with the All-Star game this year and their stance on the Georgia legislation. Where do you read all of that when it comes to Major League Baseball, Ken?
Well, I think Major League Baseball, like many industries, had a bit of a reckoning last year with the George Floyd alleged murder. And I think it really, to Commissioner Manfred's credit, he made an effort to really engage more with the players, obviously the players of color in particular. And I really admired what baseball did by moving the All-Star game out of there. I think had he not, it would have been a nonstop topic, court of public opinion, if you will. Sure. I mean, Dave Roberts, Dodgers manager, who's going to be the National League manager, already had, before the decision, he said, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to go to Atlanta, participate in this game, not after what they did there. So he was going to be asked that another 10 times. Have you decided yet? Have you decided yet? Every player, and let's be honest, more particularly players of color, would have been asked about this. So now, by kind of moving as quickly as it did, no one's going to be asked about it anymore. It's a settled issue. So I thought that was very smart and sensitive to do what they did.
Yeah, and I think it was. I agree with you 100%. And it's intriguing because we sort of expect the NBA and the NFL to react in the way baseball did to comparable situations, because they are dominated by African American or black athletes. Baseball is not. Baseball is nowhere near as diverse in terms of black and white as it was years ago. Last number, I don't know if you know the number even, Ken, but last number I saw was something like 7% of all Major League Baseball players are African American.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a very small number. Mm-hmm. And they are the people, and I don't want to dismiss the significance of Hispanics, who are far greater in number in baseball, and they can be impacted by the moves, political moves made in Georgia just as well. But I thought it was a pretty aggressive move. I think we should applaud the commissioner for it.
I agree.
We had Bill Shaken on a couple weeks back, and Bob threw him the
money.
So we asked him about the same time in the show that we're going to ask you, best player in baseball right now.
Oh gosh, I'll stop you with Mike Trout.
Same answer, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, exactly the same answer. And his team is actually playing better this year. I think the thing we are always surprised with Trout is that and Shaken brought it up too, that he always re-signs there, but the team has not performed obviously like the other team in the city of Los Angeles. But he's very comfortable living where he lives and playing where he plays.
Last night, one other thing. Last night we saw a no-hitter. And I'll tell you what my first reaction was, and I'm intrigued by yours. I had come to the point where I was uncertain as to whether we were going to see a complete game in Major League Baseball this year. Forget a no-hitter. And that's the first thing that hit me is, wow, they let a guy stay in for 9 innings? tell me about this evolution in the sport from your perspective, because while not as old as John and I, you are old enough to remember when complete games were not a complete rarity. And yeah, when guys actually got multiple good pitchers had multiple shutouts in a year, and no hitters happened on a reasonably regular basis, every month or 6 weeks or so, we got one. We are not in that time now. Pitchers are used completely differently. And I have not adjusted to accepting the new philosophy.
Bob wants a three-man rotation.
Spawn and Sane on a day of rain. and I don't subscribe to the theory that this methodology that they're using with pitchers, especially starters, helps prevent injuries. Because all you got to do is look at the IR. And there's plenty of pitchers on there, and I argue no fewer than there were 15 years ago before this six-man rotation, don't throw more than 100 pitches stuff happened. Where are you on all this, Mr. Davidoff?
Oh, wow. I mean, I think we could talk about this just, you know, alone for 40 minutes, right? There's so many different elements to this. You guys know Art Shamsky, the 1969 Met. He has his own podcast. I think I'm the only person on the planet who does not have his own podcast at this point. Art was gracious enough to have me as a guest, and we were talking about similar issues. What I said to him is, Art, all of this comes from a good place. Like, all of this comes from very smart people trying to figure out the best way to win baseball games and World Series titles. So when we talk about pitching, you know, there's a lot of data that shows you third time through the lineup, your success rate diminishes a lot. We saw that even yesterday when the Yankees lifted Kluber after, I think it was 77, 78 pitches and four innings. And now fold into that all these biomechanics that are in the picture now for how to max out your effort and just philosophically, you know, go as hard as you can for as long as you can. So these guys aren't being trained to run marathons anymore, complete games. They're being trained to just give us everything you got. And if it's five innings, if it's four innings, that's okay. Because now we can bring in four relievers for one inning each who can also fire BBs and dominate. So there's been all these different elements. And Bob, when you talk about the injured list, you know, first of all, I would argue that many guys' careers just ended, you know, years ago rather than, okay, I'm not feeling right. Let me go on the injured list, you know. Think bigger picture here. And obviously because of the money these guys are getting, teams are more protective of those assets. So again, all these go into play. I'm not disputing your argument that the game is worse for this. I'm not saying the game is better for this. What I am saying is this is all coming from a good place.
The predictability of the game though now is, I mean, everybody, if they understand the analytics, the predictability of the game is everybody knows what's going to happen next. So there goes a bit of the human side. The other thing I think we all have to be concerned about, because you can bring those four pitchers in that inning, is the length of the game. And, you know,
we've been fighting that for decades.
We got to get back to, remember, the last time I saw a two-hour baseball game. The last time I saw a two-hour baseball game was
Roy Halladay. Yeah, maybe Roy Halladay. I remember he threw 157.
Yeah,
in a complete game and quick. You were right, David, on this. That is a topic for a much lengthier conversation, and I have about a million things to throw at you, but time is our enemy now. So all we can do is offer you the opportunity, if you wish, to rejoin us at some point down the road. And we hope you will, because we enjoyed the conversation. We thank you.
Thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure. And just good luck to your Jays in Dunedin. And happy to come on anytime.
Ken Davidoff of the New York Post. We'll take the break and come back and wrap it in a moment after these messages. Bob McCown, John Shannon, got a couple of minutes to wrap it up. Our thanks again to Ken Davidoff for joining us from the New York Post and cautiously agreeing to join us again sometime down the road. Although I would like to, because we got into this conversation, this thing, state of the game kind of stuff, right at the end of the program. And you know, Davidoff opened up a can of worms when he said, you know, this is a topic we could discuss for another 40 minutes. And you know me, I'd be happy to.
It's the one thing that has, and Ken agreed, it hasn't helped the game. It helps teams win, but it hasn't helped the game in the terms of being an entertainment factor. I mean, when you and I can sit here and we can be 3,000 miles apart or 300 feet apart and know fully well that when that starting pitcher gets to 98 pitchers and goes through the the other team's lineup twice, he's not staying. And that's the human aspect of baseball disappears. And I like the human aspect of sports. That's one of the reasons I'm involved.
You brought it up. We got a very short time, but the one thing I will say is sports is monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah.
Remember only, watch Moneyball and remember the Oakland A's and Billy Beane and the way he conducted himself. And in the years right after that, everybody went to it. If something works that is different, everyone will adopt it and they will tell you it's the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Bob, we could talk for 40 minutes about this.
And we will, just not today. Goodbye, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for watching or listening.